Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We strike a keynote this hour in our collaboration with the Quincy Institute in a radio podcast series we're calling In Search of Monsters. John Quincy Adams coined that phrase two centuries ago, the peacekeeping diplomat who would become the sixth president of his young country. Searching for monsters abroad, he said, was what the United States did not and would not do. Our guest, Andrew Bacevich, put the Quincy name on his network of historians and commentators as a way of asking how war became an American habit. Unshakable long after the last great Soviet-Russian monster fell apart 30 years ago. Andy Bacevich, your life in and out of Army uniform can serve as a sort of personal parable of what this country has been through. You could start, as you've written, on a day in the very early 1990s at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin. You were an Army colonel on the way up. The Berlin Wall had just come down and something snapped. So at the age of 41, you set about remapping the history of what you were looking at.
I was a serving officer at the time, assigned to a unit in West Germany, about to become part of a united Germany. The centerpiece of my military service, apart from a year in Vietnam, was waging the Cold War. Waging the Cold War meant being prepared for World War III. We believed, we in the officer corps believed, had learned to believe that readying ourselves for that contingency was the best way to prevent it from happening. So what we called at the time combat readiness was the highest value. When I think about my time in the service back in those days, whether in Germany or back in the U.S., I mean, I recall how hard we worked to be ready for the event that we were trying to prevent. And part of our perspective was that the other guys were 10 feet tall, that the Red Army was at least as well equipped as we were, and that they too were combat ready, and that therefore everything kind of was held by a single thread. A miscalculation could have all this come apart in a climactic war, which inevitably would have ended up being a nuclear war. So here we were, I say we, my wife and I and a couple of our kids. It was our first visit ever to Berlin. It was winter, it was wet, it was rainy, it was dark. And we had, because I wanted to, walked down the Unter den Linden, this avenue. And we did it on the east side, on the old east side, and approached the Brandenburg Gate, which I think to all members of my generation really was the ultimate symbol of the Cold War itself, this point of division. And you're right, as we came up to the gate itself, there were a bunch of Russian soldiers kind of sitting around on the ground, blankets spread out, with tchotchkes.
Trinkets.
Wristwatches, you know, medallions, hats that they were selling to whoever would buy them. Obviously soldiers who were not well cared for, not doing well, needed to pick up some cash, some change. And I bought myself a wristwatch that night, a wristwatch that belonged to the Armored Corps, said right on the watch. I think it lasted 2 weeks before it broke. And this moment did make a deep impression on me. And above all, what it showed me was that the adversary was not anywhere as formidable as I had been led to believe and as I had come to believe, that there was something behind my outlook on history, on contemporary events, that was deeply false. So it was a moment of revelation.
Go back even further, Andy, if you will, to I see the kid in normal Illinois who wants to be a soldier and goes to West Point to be a good one, a leader of soldiers. And then it's Vietnam. I haven't heard enough about your experience of Vietnam, your thinking in Vietnam, which I only saw as a correspondent, but it told me a lot. What were you seeing and feeling in, what was it, 71?
Yeah, I served there from summer of 1970 to the summer of 1971, meaning toward the latter part of the war, after Tet, after President Nixon had already announced the drawdown,
right,
where the centerpiece of U.S. policy was a declared intention to turn the war back to the South Vietnamese because we wanted to evacuate. We were looking for that decent interval that would allow us to put the war behind us without actually having to acknowledge failure and defeat. I think my honest answer to your question is I tried real hard not to think about the war.
Oh.
I was serving. You know, my time at West Point from the summer of 1965 to the summer of 1969 coincided with, first of all, the buildup of U.S. forces in Vietnam and the most intense period of combat. 1965, certainly I would be among those who accepted that the cause was an important one, that the United States had a vital U.S. national interest in ensuring the survival of the Republic of Vietnam. Why did I believe that? Because I believed in the domino theory, because I believed that communism was a monolith, and that therefore a communist North Vietnam aspiring to reunify the country, that represented a direct threat to the well-being of the United States. That's what the United States government said. That was their justification for the war. That's what I believed. By the time I got there in 1970, that was a difficult belief to sustain. And once Richard Nixon visited the People's Republic in 1972, of course, it was impossible to sustain notions of monolithic communism. That said, as a serving officer, I think I was reluctant to think critically, deeply, to question orthodoxy. Let me say that there was any number of my classmates from West Point who I think were a lot savvier than I was and a lot more willing to pose fundamental questions. It was only over time, for example, in the subsequent years that finally brought me to the Brandenburg Gate, that I began to think more deeply about Vietnam. Not so much about my personal role, which was really insignificant, but about where Vietnam fits in our national narrative. And I really have come to believe that it wasn't simply a mistake. Obviously, it was a mistake. Obviously, it was an unnecessary war.
Mm.
I think it was a crime. And of course, that's what the people on the other side of the barricades back in the 60s, meaning the anti-war movement, the protesters, that's what they were saying at the time, that this was a criminal undertaking. I wasn't willing to accept that then. I think that they were certainly right.
Yeah. I went there in 1967 with General Jumping Jim Gavin, who was trying to organize a political opposition. I'd heard all those lines about its vitality to us. The main thing I remember is I went out on my own a lot, but meeting a respected Buddhist priest who said to me in French, "C'est difficile pour l'éléphant écraser la puce." It's very hard for an elephant to crush a flea. And I found the whole thing, well, there were two things. The American military machine, and I was up in those helicopters. Those guys were fantastic. But there was something absurd in the undertaking. General Gavin was trying to present himself as an opponent of the war, but his executive officer in the old 82nd Airborne was then in charge of the war, Westmoreland, and he talked him out of it. But I'm interested in your getting through it with those doubts. In your book, Washington Rules, published in 2010, sometime after your Berlin epiphany, you wrote, "The rules of force projection all over the planet and a readiness to intervene in remote conflicts were propelling the United States toward insolvency and perpetual war. Today, 2022, are we there yet? Can we see it coming? Have we corrected course at any point?" As General Petraeus famously said, "Tell me how this ends."
Well, we certainly have not course corrected. Let me provide a little bit more context to that quote from the book. In the wake of World War II, as the United States recognized the necessity in engaging in a Cold War against the Soviets, that led to a major redesign, a reformulation of U.S. national security policy, and by extension, a major redesign of U.S. forces. What did that mean? That meant that the United States, as never before in its history, was going to design forces as instruments of global power projection. The object of the exercise from this point forward down to the present day is not to defend the United States of America per se, not to prevent California or Texas or Massachusetts from being overrun. The object of the exercise was to position U.S. forces around the globe and to hold in readiness U.S. forces back here in the United States that could deploy around the world. That describes the posture that we assumed at the beginning of the Cold War and throughout the Cold War. Crucially, when the Cold War ended, we continued with that posture. Cold War ends, we still keep U.S. troops positioned in Europe and in Japan and in South Korea and in the Persian Gulf. And we still continue to design U.S. forces not to protect us here, but to go fight out there, where out there is somewhere on the other side of the planet. That arrangement, not incidentally, was a very expensive one. So that the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about back in 1961, and that had come into being during the course of the Cold War, continued, persisted, with remarkably little discussion. You will recall that there was a very brief moment at the end of the Cold War, right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, when there was a very modest thought that, gosh, maybe there is a peace dividend that can be claimed. The thought was that, therefore, instead of providing the kind of resources we do to the Pentagon on an annual basis, because we're constantly getting ready for war, maybe we should divert some of those resources to other purposes domestically. Well, that didn't last. I mean, it was Saddam Hussein, very conveniently, who exploded that notion. And ever since, that notion has not been revisited. So here we are all these years later with a mammoth Pentagon budget that gets larger year by year without any real serious justification, and with U.S. forces still deployed around the world. Something on the order of, what, 750 or 780 foreign bases, along with wars that seem to be all but perpetual. So there's a narrative that goes back to the very beginning of the Cold War.
Coming up, the sorrows of empire back home. This is Open Source.
It's the remarkably little discussion that you mentioned that fascinates me so and bugs me so. You were a soldier, you're now an activist, but meantime you've become a formidable historian, Andy Bacevich, of this whole thing. How far back do you want to take these aggressive impulses that seem to have us by the throat?
You could name any number of dates. I have to admit that my favorite one is 1898.
Okay.
You know, the Spanish-American War. I believe we declared war on Spain in April of 1898. I think we ended that war in a formal sense in August. So it was a very, very brief conflict. We learned back in grade school or high school that that war centered on an effort on the part of the United States to liberate Cuba from Spanish colonial rule. That's what it was all about. Well, it wasn't all about that. And one of the ways we know it wasn't all about that is by looking at the aftermath of the abbreviated campaign in Cuba and posing the question, well, what happened next? And the answer to that question is that U.S. forces entered the Philippines approximately, what, 6,000, 7,000 miles west of San Francisco, and ejected the Spanish from there, occupied and subsequently annexed the Philippine archipelago. To me, that is a powerful turning point in American history. We were an imperialistic nation before then. You know, we go to war with Mexico in order to grab California. But beginning in 1898, I think imperialism, empire, the desire to exercise vast power, willing to rule over people not like us, people of color, of course. This beginning in 1898 that I think this becomes such an important theme of American history.
I agree that it's the start. It's also the start of an opposition. I mean, William James, the philosopher, said, God damn America for what it's doing in the Philippines. Mark Twain said, the talons of the American eagle don't belong on any soil but ours. Carnegie, the labor movement. There was all sorts of strenuous opposition to that whole idea, and it stayed a kind of a live argument till when? World War I, maybe.
When I was first studying this period in American history, I don't remember if it was in high school or when I was at West Point, but I remember how the anti-war movement of the time made me very uncomfortable. These were significant figures. Mark Twain, William James, for heaven's sakes. How could they question our motivations in the Philippines? And in retrospect, of course, they were absolutely right.
William James was not only right, he was eloquent and he was detailed about what we were doing to the lives of ordinary people.
And they lost the argument, of course. In other words, we did annex the Philippines, and it became part of the American Empire through the end of World War II.
Lost it in a sense, but the argument stayed lively. I think of American history since that time as a sort of continuing argument between William James and one of his not better students, Theodore Roosevelt, Mr. Bully Pulpit, Teddy Roosevelt, who embodied that whole bravado up the hill in San Juan.
The anti-imperialism movement that came out of the Spanish-American War, they lost. They lost the argument because we did indeed annex the Philippines. We did indeed incorporate it into an American empire. Now, the legacy that they left in arguing against annexing the Philippines was an important legacy. I think that probably when we try to understand the roots of the anti-war movement during Vietnam,
yep,
that there was
reaching back to
1898 and remembering what William James said or Mark Twain said, recalling that, seeing it as once more relevant. I think there's no question about that whatsoever. On the other hand, you know, if we fast forward to the post 9/11 moment, I would argue strongly that the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan and Iraq, that those need to be seen as part of our imperial history. I'm not sure that in our present moment, Twain, James, Andrew Carnegie, Jane Addams, that their arguments resonate the way they did in earlier times. Why is that? I think the answer has something to do with the American military system. This is a hobby horse of mine, the so-called all-volunteer force, which has provided the American people with an excuse not to pay attention to American imperialism, not to pay attention to our penchant for intervention and our penchant for war, because, and many others have made this point, because the American people, as the saying goes, don't have any skin in the game.
The anti-imperial wisdom flares in moments and places. I'm thinking of John F. Kennedy in Vietnam, 1951. The French are on their way out. He had good advice from American Foreign Service people, journalists too, but he said, it's there on film, this is the French war, we would be insane to get ourselves bogged down in this place. It's not our kind of war. It's not for us. Of course, he overruled that as President of the United States.
So the man who became President Kennedy was a professional politician and a pretty darn skillful one. And my sense is that beginning in 1956, when I think it's pretty clear he is eyeing the presidency, he's planning on a run, he has to revise his position on matters like Southeast Asia falling to the communists in order to maintain his political viability. He has to revise his views on military power. I mean, here's a guy who was a genuine hero in World War II.
Truly.
Who did not have a very high opinion of senior American military leadership.
Amen. It's an important point. He saw through it in many ways.
And nonetheless, as he runs for the presidency, as he positions himself to run for the presidency, shows that he's been drinking the Kool-Aid. You know, bases a candidacy upon a bogus bomber gap, a bogus missile gap, bases it on a bogus domino theory, bases it on an exaggeration of the implications of the Cuban Revolution for U.S. national security. And in a sense, he boxes himself in to a militarized approach to policy. I think historians know, for example, that once in office, Kennedy was quite clear in intending to get us out of Vietnam before the Vietnam War somehow took over the country. I believe he said, well, wait for the second term. Wait till I get elected for a second term, and then I will get us out of Vietnam. Of course, there was no second term. There was just a first term, and Kennedy's policy with regard to Vietnam in the first term was one of escalation. I think when he became president in January of 61, I think the U.S. so-called advisory forces in the country were numbered into hundreds. I believe that by the time he was assassinated, we had 17,000 U.S. troops serving in South Vietnam, and they were doing a heck of a lot more things than simply advising the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. So he made a bed that seemed to be necessary to get elected, and then when he got assassinated, Lyndon Johnson and the rest of us were stuck with the consequences.
Interesting way to put it. I think he was in a more radical turn of mind after the American University speech. He was in touch with both Khrushchev back channel and Castro. I think he had real designs.
The Cuban Missile Crisis was a genuine wake-up moment, and probably for Khrushchev as well. On the other hand, not for the U.S. national security apparatus more broadly. The prevailing Cold War assumptions, what we must do in order to assure our security and well-being, I would say they survived the missile crisis, except among people like President Kennedy.
Andy, let's talk about this remarkable Quincy Institute you've founded, and I'm tickled to be collaborating with you in a number of broadcasts. Quincy, because of the words of John Quincy Adams, who, as Secretary of State, said, he was later president, America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. That line still rings. What do you mean to do with it? What's the leverage for that fundamental impulse in our history in the world, an entirely changed world of 2022?
So John Quincy Adams, as Secretary of State, is warning the country against going abroad in search of monsters to destroy, that is to say, to embark upon militaristic or imperial adventurism, because, he said, to do so would be to put at risk our own freedom and our own democracy. And we in the Quincy Institute believe that's happened. That's where we are. We have put at risk our freedom, our democracy, because of our ill-advised wars, in particular in the aftermath of 9/11. The word that we emphasize in describing what we believe in is restraint. Restraint is not disarmament. Restraint emphatically is not isolationism. But restraint means to be prudent, realistic, skeptical when it comes to the use of force. And we believe that the United States in recent years has been anything but prudent. It's been reckless. It's cost us. It's cost us, by the estimates of some, upwards of $8 trillion. That's an astonishing sum of money. Not that anybody seems to care in our country these days about fiscal irresponsibility. But we spent something like $8 trillion in our post-9/11 wars. We've lost thousands of our own soldiers, tens of thousands of wounded. The VA is being swamped with veterans who are suffering the damage of their war service, physical, psychological. There's an epidemic. We know this. There's an epidemic of veteran suicides.
Yeah.
And, of course, that focus on what we have suffered ignores the consequences that we have visited upon others, that we profess to liberate, that we profess to want to rescue from tyranny. There are estimates that we've killed something on the order of 900,000 people since 9/11, with millions displaced. So the misuse of American military power over the last 20 or so years has been so egregious that it certainly demands a reckoning, and it also demands rethinking about the essence of U.S. policy. Now, we in the Quincy Institute like to refer to what others have called the blob. The blob is the foreign policy establishment. The blob consists of those individuals in and out of government, in journalism, in think tanks, in the military-industrial complex that basically endorse the status quo, that want the United States to continue to adhere to the principles, if you want to call them that, that have guided U.S. policies since the end of World War II. They're the adversary, and they're powerful, and they are entrenched. So we make no bones about the fact that we are in a protracted struggle. We need to change the way that Washington thinks about America's role in the world. That is a titanic undertaking.
Andy Bacevich, you have a gift for putting it in nonpartisan or political or generational or any kind of narrow terms. You call yourself convincingly a conservative person, a lifelong Catholic, old school. I love the name of the town you grew up in, Normal, Illinois. I also sense that what you're saying is people are dying to hear this. I feel on the street where I go a kind of revulsion, an embarrassment at our recent, our 50-year record in wars abroad. I think there's a big constituency out there, plain old realists, who understand that this is run to excess. My question is, how to get leverage on those people against the blob? The blob would seem to be, should be, after the record of 10 years, 20 years, 50 years since Vietnam, ready to rebel.
I think the key here is to bring greater public attention to the consequences of our follies for us, the American people. Our country's in a mess right now. I never imagined that I would live to see the day when the constitutional order would be at risk. It is. Serious people wonder whether or not we can get through the next election without our political system coming apart at the seams.
Make the military connection, if there is one.
I will, but I think it's important to expand a little bit on, it's not simply the constitutional order. It's the divisions within our country, the loss, in my judgment, of any recognized definition of the common good. You know, we see that in the hyper-partisanship. I don't mean necessarily to include Democrats and Republicans, but people who call themselves conservatives, people who call themselves Democrats, who revile one another. Now, there's all kinds of reasons why this has happened. There's all kinds of reasons that we ended up with a guy like Donald Trump as president. There's all kinds of reasons why Trumpism, this phenomenon, emerged and has exercised such influence on the contemporary scene. But I would argue strongly that one of those reasons is the misuse of American military power. Engaging in stupid and unnecessary and ill-managed wars, that is a major cause of our domestic crisis. And therefore, it's imperative, in my judgment, for us to recognize the damage we have done to ourselves by our reckless misuse of American military power, which frankly goes beyond the number of Americans killed or the number of American lives, veterans who's had their lives shattered. We've done enormous damage to the polity. And I don't think that gets anywhere near the attention that it deserves. One of the purposes of the Quincy Institute is to call attention to that, to make the argument, this is what happens when we go abroad in search of monsters to destroy.
I think it goes also to some mysterious DNA of who we are and also the way we see ourselves. I may have told you this before. Neil Ferguson, English writer, came out with a book just before the war in Iraq called Empire, basically handing over the job to us. He said, you're an empire in the closet. Go out and do your jobs. And to impose ourselves on the world. I got the book and immediately noticed on the cover, there's a picture of British ships, Union Jack flying, and they're sending incendiary bombs into the wilderness. I looked more closely. Those bombs are going into Bunker Hill, Massachusetts, Boston, the Revolutionary War, the Battle of Bunker Hill. And when I met him, I said, those are your imperial boats aiming at us. They immediately changed the cover on that book. But we are embarrassed. We think of ourselves as a country that emerged, fought its way out of an empire. There's something that doesn't sit right, especially in Vietnam, in picking up the French imperial losses in a faraway East Asian country.
I don't think that story resonates anymore.
Why not?
With our fellow citizens. You know, that we were born in a revolution against an imperial power, and therefore there's something about our DNA which is hostile to empire.
It's part of our national legend, though.
It is part of the national legend. I just don't think it has salience. What does have salience is this notion of American exceptionalism. One answer to the question, how did we get where we are today? Well, we got where we are today because we have come to believe that we are the new chosen people, chosen by God, chosen by providence, chosen by history, you know, pick one. But we are the chosen people. We are chosen to lead. We are chosen to transform the international order into some semblance of who we are and what we believe. I think that in our own time, the end of the Cold War provided a powerful impetus or reinforcement to the notion of American exceptionalism. If you look at the speeches that George W. Bush made in the aftermath of 9/11, as he explained why we're going to do what we're going to do, if you look in particular at his second inaugural address, they are eloquent, genuinely eloquent, in expressing his understanding that there is a providential purpose that we have been summoned to fulfill. And now, as we go to war in Afghanistan, as we prepare to invade Iraq, we are fulfilling that purpose.
So it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world.
Coming up, bringing that exceptionalism down to earth. This is Open Source. I wondered for a moment whether our guest, Andrew Bacevich, had fallen under the spell of George W. Bush.
You bought a lot more of that exceptionalism than I felt I had to. It is an amazing country. I like the line that the country can't be all bad that came up with the U.S. Constitution, baseball, and jazz. That, to me, is American exceptionalism. But it has its obvious limits. And I didn't buy a word of George Bush saying, we've got to go into Iraq and then Afghanistan to deliver God's intent of freedom for all people. This just struck me as much oil nonsense.
It has been an ideological project driven by a conviction of American military supremacy, that the world is supposed to embrace American-style liberal democratic capitalism. And if anybody is reluctant to accept that program, then we've got the United States Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps available to change their minds. I'm oversimplifying, of course, but I think that's what we have been engaged in since the end of the Cold War. And in particular, what we've been engaged in since 9/11, it doesn't work. It's based on false premises. Humankind is not destined to embrace American-style liberal democratic capitalism. And at least as troubling, it turns out that American military power is nowhere near as effective, as invincible, as we fancied back when we were getting ready to invade Iraq. It turns out we can be beaten, and we have been beaten. But let me own up to the fact that I myself, probably for the first 50 years of my life, was a true believer. If you're born in the Midwest at the end of World War II, if you grow up in a conservative Catholic household, both my parents were veterans of World War II, you embraced precepts of American exceptionalism. My parents, who I love dearly and miss, believed unquestionably in the specialness and the chosenness of our country. But it seems to me that in recent decades, it's gotten us into trouble. I tend to mark the turning point in contemporary American history with the fall of the Berlin Wall, that in many respects, that's when things went south. That's when American exceptionalism became something that was overweening. That's when confidence in American military power went from embracing American military power as something that was necessary in order to prevent World War III. It now became something that we needed to put to work. We needed to use it because it was an instrument that could be used to solve problems. The change in our outlook on American exceptionalism, the change in our outlook on military power, led us down the path to Iraq and Afghanistan. More significantly, I think, down the path to Trump, Trumpism, internal division, culture wars, and the predicament that we face today.
I guess I think there's a deeper popular revulsion from all the war that is to be celebrated and played upon, especially, I must say, among African Americans who see through our follies on this sort of thing very clearly. A lot of poor Americans, I think we give the blob too much credit for speaking for even the great American middle class. But the question is how to bring everybody to a more sober, more realistic understanding of what these wars cost.
I think you're onto something when you refer to broadly to the Black Lives Matter movement, I guess.
Well, now the focus, black church life, black
okay,
street
but,
life.
But the focus of the black community that I should not even pretend to speak for.
Nor
I. But the focus of the black community, I think, tends to be on domestic issues. I think I'd make the point more sharply, and that is that the trajectory of U.S. foreign policy and national security policy since World War II, that's a trajectory that leads to Cold War, leads to Korea, leads to Vietnam, leads ultimately to the fall of the Berlin Wall, and subsequently to what we end up calling the global war on terrorism. That trajectory stems directly from what I might call a white outlook on America's role in the world.
Interesting.
A white formulation. A formulation, for example, that privileges the competition between great powers that, with very few exceptions, are white. So the perspective is one that does have a racialist connotation. We were a racist nation that actually saw racial difference as part of the rationale for creating empire after 1898. Remember, President McKinley referred to the people of the Philippines as little brown brother and insisted that we have a responsibility to care for, to civilize, to democratize little brown brother. I mean, that sort of thinking continued toward the end, it probably continued into the beginning of the 21st century, if we sort of peel back the surface of the rationale for what we tried to do in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. I'm interested in your life and your experience because it's the kernel of everything you're recommending to voters, to people. After Berlin, when you saw the worn-out Brandenburg Gate and the poor veterans of the Red Army, then what? You went to the Gulf War, and I'd love to hear more about it. The first Gulf War.
So, yes, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, I was commanding an armored cavalry regiment in Germany, headquartered in Fulda. We deployed, we engaged in training exercises, provided for local security. I had been warned in particular to be wary of the possibility of some kind of a repeat of the Beirut bombing, you know, to be on the lookout for a terrorist threat. I completely overlooked the actual threat. And the actual threat was a motor pool fire. Mm. Our vehicles were uploaded with ammunition. The fire caused enormous damage to equipment, injured more than 100 of my soldiers, coming in the wake of what had seemed to be the perfect campaign of Operation Desert Storm. I obviously had screwed up. I had screwed up in my failure.
You screwed up how?
Because I failed to anticipate the actual threat to my soldiers and my unit. I don't want to make a grandiose comparison because but it kind of fits. I failed in the same sense that Admiral Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short failed with regard to Pearl Harbor. They did not anticipate the threat that they were going to confront.
Wow.
They didn't anticipate that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor using carrier-based aircraft. They were caught by surprise. I didn't anticipate the possibility of a horrendous fire in a motor pool.
This was the incident at Doha.
Yeah. I was properly held responsible for that. I fully accepted then and today responsibility for that. And frankly, had personal difficulty because I had brought shame to the regiment that I was devoted to. So what next? Well, I decided that I would retire. Now, for our purposes, I think the significance in terms of my outlook is this. Most of your listeners who have served any substantial period of time in the armed forces, whether the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, whatever, probably appreciate the extent to which that is an all-encompassing way of life. It's not unlike being a monk in a monastery. Your life in the service defines the center of everything. And I had lived that life for 23 years. And so when I got out, and this took a period of time for me to get there, but when I got out, for the first time in my adult life, I was freed from these institutional loyalties, institutional constraints, and therefore I began to think differently about American history and differently, in particular, about America's role in the world. So my intellectual liberation, that probably overstates it, coincided with a moment of significant, even radical change in basic U.S. policy. And so as I then began to reflect on and write about the implications of that change, that became an important theme of my work. I became a critic of American militarism, a critic of U.S. foreign policy, and someone who tries to identify the connecting tissue between what we do in the world and what's happening to our country at home. And that's kind of been my preoccupation for the last, I guess, going on 30 years now.
I had read your first book, Andy. You were well established as a critic and a writer before the other unspeakable loss you suffered in the Gulf, in the death of your son in 2007. We needn't talk about that. I can't imagine the pain of that loss. But it came after some other light you had seen.
Yeah, I think the death of my son, I guess I would say it affirmed the views that I had come to in the wake of the Cold War. Now, I admired greatly, and still admire, the choice that my son made in serving our country. Needless to say, I mourn his death. I lament, not simply for his sake, for the sake of many others. I lament our involvement in that needless war. But certainly I'm proud of him.
You should be. Early in this new year, Andy, the disarray of the American departure from Afghanistan kind of essentializes where we're at, seems to me. 20 years, trillions of dollars of a war that made no sense from the beginning. We're all feeling, dare I say, a little desperate. Which way is up? Under the heading of strategy, the great Chaz Freeman, diplomat, ambassador, strategist, said to us, the United States-China relationship now is a strategy-free zone. And I think you might say that about a lot of our thinking and doing in the world today. How do you see the strategic reality of today? Where are we? Who's got it? Which way is the wind and power moving? And what is to be done about it? Big question, but I mean, think strategically for us. I want to hear what it sounds like.
Well, I think the point I would begin with, and this is something that we at the Quincy Institute absolutely believe in, is that the existential threat is the climate crisis.
Interesting.
That's not the only concern we have, but if we, the United States, and more broadly, other nations, particularly the great powers, fail to address the climate crisis, we're doomed. And doomed may not be too strong a term. The second imperative for the United States is we've got to repair our country. We have to repair our democracy. We have to restore some sense of a common good before we embark upon some new adventure whether it's vis-a-vis the People's Republic or whether it's vis-a-vis another adversary like Russia. I think our country is in deep trouble. I think many of us feel that way.
Which symptoms do you see especially?
The symptoms of being in trouble?
Yeah.
Well, I think the absence of any conception of the common good. I think the hyper-partisanship that is in our politics. I think the abandonment of any principle whatsoever on the part of the Republican Party. You know, we have a two-party tradition. We need to have two parties that compete, but that compete on the basis of certain identifiable principles. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not even a liberal. But it does seem to me that I can identify certain principles that Democrats, more broadly speaking, adhere to. I don't see any principles in the Republican Party unless, you know, loyalty to Donald Trump counts as a principle, and it certainly does not in my book. So we just have a lot of repair to do. I mean, you know, we can go on the economic inequality that besets us, greater today than was the case during the infamous Gilded Age. How can that be acceptable? The ineptitude of government agencies in responding to crises, whether we're talking about the pandemic or forest fires on the West Coast or a porous southern border. I mean, the federal government in particular can't seem to get anything done right. That needs fixing.
Looking at the pictures of Nixon in China 50 years ago with Chaz Freeman, we were struck. Nixon, though we couldn't love him in the Kennedy era, had the marks of a statesman and of a strategist. He knew what he was doing, and he did something very, very big. I mean, the obvious replay would be for Joe Biden to say, I'll be in Beijing next week, and Mr. Xi and I will be talking about this climate, which we share, and we are both impoverishing as it stands, but we're going to do something about it. Who in the world would oppose that, but who in reality would expect it of him now? And why don't we? Why don't you guys get busy on recreating the next 50 years of the atmosphere?
Well, you know, in their day, and Lord knows I'm not defending them more broadly, but in their day, Nixon and Kissinger recognized an opportunity and an imperative for bold action with respect to China. And they seized that opportunity and thereby transformed the Cold War, setting in motion all kinds of consequences, some of which we might find not particularly good. I mean, the rise of China ultimately comes from that moment. But above all, it was the recognition for the need for bold action that departs from the orthodox narrative.
Yep.
And I don't see that inclination in the Biden administration or, quite frankly, anywhere else in the political establishment. Doesn't mean it's not there. I just don't see it.
Andy Bacevich, your life is your answer, and it's a good one. A lot of work to be done.
Well, and unless we can deal effectively with the climate crisis, it's going to end catastrophically, I think, that a changing climate is going to make the world something close to being uninhabitable. And as that occurs over a period of decades, there will likely be more conflict, more wars among increasingly desperate peoples. Mm. And that's why I have come to the view that there is no higher priority than addressing the climate crisis, and that therefore the geopolitical imperative of the moment is that the great powers, preeminently the United States and the People's Republic, need to take the leadership in addressing that problem in an effective way. Whether leaders in Beijing and Washington can be sufficiently enlightened in order to take that on, I think is an open question.
Let's get busy, Andy Bacevich. I'm so glad we're collaborating with you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Andrew Bacevich is Professor Emeritus at Boston University. He's the author of The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. He's also
president of the Quincy Institute, which is collaborating with us on our limited series, In Search of Monsters, The Rise and Fall of American Empire.
Learn more about our partners at the Quincy Institute and their interest in restraint as international policy at quincyinst.org. That's Quincy, I-N-S-T, .org. Our show this week was produced by Mary McGrath and Adam Coleman, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.
Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of smart, thoughtful, independent podcasts. If you're already nostalgic for Christmas 2021 or looking forward to Christmas 2022, check out the latest episode of the Hub and Spoke show, Iconography. Host Charles Gustine brings back a beloved and newly remastered 2016 episode about Charles Dickens' timeless story, A Christmas Carol. It's called Ebenezer Scrooge. You'll find it at iconographypodcast.com. And you can check out the whole Hub and Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org.